today about trying to use the encoded debris of core collapse supernovae to understand fundamental properties of their nature. And myself, like many people in this room, want to be able to look at something like that, which is EO-102 in the Small Magellanic Cloud, or that, which is Cassiopeia in our own galaxy, and understand what kind of star it came from and what was the explosion mechanism that allowed it to be what it is today. Now, to understand these questions, I've come to the appreciation that they're related to one another. Because when I started off as a young grad student many moons ago, I was chiefly concerned with this. How do stars explode? What is the explosion mechanism? But information that I can't run away from in the last 5 or so years has led me to understand that in order to answer this question, I have to be appreciative and have good constraints on this question. And not just the type of star that explodes, but detailed information about the stellar structure, the interior into which the explosion is proceeding. Now, there's various ways to approach this. In the supernova community, they have strength in numbers, right? Hundreds of supernovae found every year, and they have thousands in the catalog now. And you can get information from light curves and spectra and spectropolarimetry. There are many, but of course they are distant. And every example is an unresolved point source. And extracting detailed three-dimensional information, kinematic and chemical, particularly about core processes, is inherently ambiguous. Now, I'm amongst friends here, and I don't need to convince you that there's value in supernova remnants. So at the cost of only having a relative handful by which to study, they offer great detailed investigations that are impossible to achieve at extragalactic distances. Right? It's important for us to keep knocking on the doors of the supernova community because this offers details that they want to run away from. Okay? Case in point, a few weeks ago at Harvard, there was a conference, the Transient Sky, part of the Sackler series. The first I learned of this conference was this poster, which is just outside my office, and I was excited. Wow, transient, local to Harvard, and there's the Crab Nebula. But then as I paged through the program, I noticed that although they're showing a supernova remnant front and center, there is actually no supernova remnant talks. I wrote to the chair, Avi Loeb, about this, and saying that some unjust crime had been committed here. You had hijacked a supernova remnant and put it on here without any proper representation, showing it as just a pretty face. He had no real consolation other than he asked me to chair one of the sessions, and I got this really nifty USB memory stick that reads the transient sky. Okay, people in the supernova community, because they're only having, the imagination can run wild. So while this is a vivid, exciting depiction of GRB 130427, right, this, of course, is fantasy. It's an artist's conception, because the reality is this. They're drawing all that information from a dot, and I've made it intentionally difficult to see, right? It's a dot in the sky, and you're trying. We're very good with dots in the sky as astronomers, right? We can collect photons, understand the spectral energy distribution, etc., but that's what we're working with. Okay? And in the supernova community, yes, this is an exciting depiction of supernova 2011 DH. Don't want to be on this planet or the many others that happen to be in the system. But again, this is fantasy, because the reality is that this is just one system in an extragalactic field. And don't be distracted by the pretty M51. Again, we're just working with a point source. Here's a remnant, right? Ladies and gentlemen, this is reality, right? And it offers great detailed analysis. We can map the ejecta, its kinematic and chemical properties. In some instances, like in Cas-A, we can watch the ejecta actually evolve with time. Okay. So I've been working with many very bright people and trying to understand the kinematic properties of starting with Cas-A, but then evolving to other remnants. And this is part of the original work done for my PhD thesis. where we looked at the optical properties of Cas-A and mapped it out. And I can go into the details about how this reconstruction was made later, but just looking at it, I hope you get an appreciation that it's not random, that indeed there is large-scale coherent structure. I make this point time and time again because it wasn't that long ago that people didn't believe this and or thought that the rings were besides the point. I want to argue today that they're invaluable measure of what's going on in a supernova. And I believe now we're going to zoom back and see the entire representation, including the jets. But today we're chiefly concerned with the main shell. This distribution we can talk another time. Oh, and incidentally, there is a web app that I've made. I encourage you to try and check it out. You can play around and manipulate the remnant, and this is supposed to be a web page of ongoing work. All right. If you didn't see the rings in the three-dimensional, let's look at a nice 2D plane where I've made a Mercator projection. So I fit kind of a globe to the ejecta shell and projected it down. So now we have continents of ejecta rings. Okay. I don't think you can hide from this. You can see the largest one here, okay, which dominates a lot of the surface. And then we can see other rings here, no less than 6 in total. Some things to take away. One, there's a half a dozen. There aren't dozens of rings that dot the remnant. And two, as I mentioned, we have one dominant structure and then others that are about half the size. So we're going to start working our way backwards in thought. So if there are rings, what are the origin of the rings? And it was proposed, Blond and Borkowski and Reynolds, that perhaps these rings are actually cross-sections of bubbles that make up the remnant. Well, we went out to test this. And we put a long slit across the face of the remnant. And we tried to see if there was anything unshocked, because there was hints of it in the images. We saw this diffuse, very faint gas. Now, some people aren't fortunate enough, such as myself, to stare at spectra all day, so let me explain what's going on. Here's the long slit. Okay? This is the reverse shock heated ejecta. Okay? In an interior, you don't see much. Here are the regions of interest, and now this is the two-dimensional spectrum. This is spatial, following the slit, and this is dispersion. Okay? So here and here, you can see the top and bottom of the reverse shock heated shell, which is dense and bright. And then if you look here and here, you can see large-scale coherent structure, right, that wraps from front, because this is blue-shifted, to the back. And this is around the sulfur three lines, getting in the near infrared, where we start to avoid a lot of the foreground extinction known to exist towards Cas-A. Okay. Now, let me tell you, when we saw this, it blew our mind. Right? Look at this structure, all the way front to back, connected. And it's diffuse. So presumably, this is unshocked ejecta that's being illuminated by the light bulb of reverse shock heated ejecta, which is showering X-ray UV photons. So we went ahead and mapped out the interior, and this is the result that came out not long ago. So we're no longer just looking at the reverse shock ejecta, but now the interior as well. And lo and behold, the interior structures connected with the main shell rings that we saw. This animation is running through sections where the main shell rings connect to these interior structures. Now, it's not a perfect map, i.e., we don't see multiple caverns, but there are certainly two dominant lobes that we can make out, maybe three or four in total. But in general, the largest cavity corresponds with the largest ring, and we have this neat region in front that maps out with a cavity in the front. Yes. So again, the point is that there's large-scale coherent structure, presumably imprinted in early on in the explosion. Okay. Well, if there are bubbles, where did the bubbles come from? We had some press associated with this event. And I think this encapsulates it quite nicely. So radioactive bubbles may have punched holes in supernova's heart. So let me go here. And we saw this picture today, which I love. I love seeing some of the same plots because it shows that many of us are converging on the same answer. So this is a simulation. This is seconds after explosion. And this is hours after explosion. This has been driven by uneven neutrino heating. You can see here, later in the explosion, how the nickel-rich material through Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities has been made its way outward ahead of the oxygen, which is in red, and carbon, which is in green. Okay? So these nickel-rich plumes can move out ahead into lighter elements, and through radioactive decay, okay, have a pressure that pushes out on these elements and form these cavities in the interior of the supernova. If you look now at the observation, okay, in red is the optical that I showed you just a moment ago. In blue is the X-ray emitting iron-rich material. And I don't know what happened to the reference, but this is through work done by Tracy Delaney et al. With many other people that she used information from as well. Notice how the large ring has a large deposit of iron-rich material. And in fact, any region where there is X-ray emitting iron, there's a ring that wraps around it. So it seems to be a neat connection between these Rayleigh-Taylor-rich outflows seen in the simulations and the cavities that we see in CASE. Now, there are many caveats to this, one being that this is hours after explosion, and this is centuries after explosion. But seemed well enough for a PhD thesis, and I thought, oh, problem solved. But the devil are in the details. Oh, the pictures didn't show up. That's unusual. I hope it didn't show. Okay, technical problem, but let me describe it like this. In these plots, they are showing in the x-axis the velocity of material, and in the y-axis the amount of material at that velocity. Okay? So they're looking at, so in this case, I have the actual output of this result and another result as well by another group. These groups are simulating the explosion and then trying to map out the elements and their distribution, what velocities they achieve. Notice how they can, through mixing, they can get to velocities upwards of 4,000 kilometers per second. And I've highlighted in blue, this is hilariously bad. So this is, in blue here is the nickel in this simulation, and in purple is the nickel in this simulation. Notice it goes out to 4,000, but by far, the majority of the material is at velocities below 2,000 kilometers per second. And this goes to first-order approximation, which is to say, conservation of momentum. The heaviest stuff is going to remain deeply seated, but you're free to mix out some portion of that to outer velocities. Okay. However, now this should work somewhat. In the case of CASE, where we estimate there to be about a tenth of a solar mass, it sits out well above that. Right? And if you look at this naively, you would think, well, if there's this much in CASE, then there must be orders of magnitude more in the interior. Now, obviously, this is false. Nobody believes that there's a sun's worth of iron sitting inside of CASE. Okay. So we're led to believe that either the simulations are not following the mixing properly, and or more iron remains to be found inside CASE. Now, let me say this. I've kind of made a slanted straw man argument because these simulations have been geared towards understanding 87A, which had a hydrogen-rich star, progenitor star. Okay? CASE was hydrogen-poor. So it's not fair to compare that progenitor system with CASE. And in fact, this is the point I'm going to emphasize many times, that in fact, the details of the progenitor star will change the evolution of the explosion. And so it's going to be exciting to see once we start pushing in that boundary how the mixing affects the species distribution, and specifically the nickel. But of course, to give them hold on whether they have reality in mind, we need to have firm constraints on the amount of iron that is in CASE and other remnants. Now, that's a problem. This problem was somewhat touched upon by Laura Lopez, where she showed the new star result of CASE. And just to briefly reiterate, there's basically some kind of mismatch between the distribution of titanium, 44, and iron. They should most models predict that they should trace each other pretty well, but they don't. So one idea is that, well, there may be cold iron sitting around in this neighborhood that we're not privy to. We don't know for sure. This is a problem. So I'm going to try and emphasize to you that there is a common phenomenon of cavity-filled interior remnants, and not just in Cassay, and that this is actually found in a variety of extragalactic supernovae as well. That's funny. A lot of these things aren't working out. Okay, so I'm going to go to this picture instead. Cassay and EO-102. Cassay is about 330 years. This is approximately 1 to 2,000 years. A lot of similarities, but a lot of differences as well. Differences in their chemical abundances. This is sulfur and oxygen rich. This has relatively poor sulfur, but oxygen and neon rich. This is dynamically, quote-unquote, younger than Cassay. They seem to come from two different progenitor mass, zero-age main sequence stars, and from different environments. This is in the galaxy. This is in low metallicity of EO1, of the Small Magellanic Cloud. But if we do a little bit of gaming that I did on the bus one day, and you flip it around, okay, and then you highlight certain sections in this little top hat, they seem to have some similarity. And this compelled me to do a detailed 3D reconstruction, which I'm just nearing towards the end. Thankfully, EO-102 has a photoionized interior, just like Cassay, so you can see the internal, I argue, unshocked ejecta. And it has this cavity-like interior. There's a large one as well. I can't make the same kind of Mercator projection, but I'm working on various angles to illustrate that there's large arcs like those in that, representing the cavities that fill its interior. So I started with the remnants. Now we're going to work towards the intermediate-aged or middle-aged supernovae, much like Bill was talking about earlier this week. And I want to make a chain of understanding to show that these features can be found all across this continuum. I did this experiment where what am I showing here? This is all the spectra that went into making that original three-dimensional reconstruction. This is several weeks of telescope time and several years of my life in making. I did the experiment where I took the spectra across the face of the remnant and integrated it. So I simulated what Cassay would look like as an extragalactic source, right? I blurred it out so that the supernova community could understand what's going on. And you can see here, so the lines are broad. This is all Doppler broadening, and O3 would normally be much stronger because I haven't corrected for reddening here. But this is what the basic lookout would be. And you can compare this to other remnants. Here's the one that Bill was talking about. And of the various things I could touch upon, I want to emphasize the comparison to this here, 1993J. Why? Well, we know that Cassay and the extragalactic supernova 1993J are of the same variety because we're fortunate enough to obtain light echo spectroscopy. So this is this fantastic science where light from the original supernova goes off in various directions, bounces off dust sheets, and then at a later time comes towards us. Right? And not only do we detect these things, but we can put a slit on it and obtain a spectrum and classify it according to our classification scheme. And you can see here, there's Cassay and there is 93J. And we have the more exciting, even more, is in the sense that the light goes off in various directions, right? So that means you're looking at the supernova from various directions. And when you do that, you find that the spectra are not entirely the same. They have different velocities, and this gives evidence of asymmetry. I'm going to touch on this a bit more later. Anyhow, what's nifty is that if you look at that integrated spectrum of Cassay, and you compare that with what we see in 93J, there are strong similarities in the overall morphology. Okay? Now, a couple of caveats. One is that, so this is the velocity span of Cassay, which is less than 93J. Completely expected, because as the reverse shock moves its way inward, it samples smaller and smaller velocities. Okay? And then the scale difference, okay, just this is arbitrary. I'm just looking at the general features. And so isn't it nifty that you start, okay, you go up this hill and you come down, and then you go to the top of the hill, right? And then you come down and there's a few rocky ledges along the way. Okay? But overall, some real agreement. And the exciting thing here is, if we didn't have this, right, to the unresolved eye in the extragalactic community, these are just clumps, right? This vague term, or blobs of ejecta. But we have the resolution here of Cas A, so I can say that this feature is actually associated with that blue shifted ring. So we're getting closer to making this connection that these aren't just blobs, but they may be associated with these large-scale structure that we see in Cas A. And we know that they're a similar type of explosion, so it's not that much of a leap of imagination. Oh, okay. So this is kind of an interlude in the talk, flying donuts. So I now want to be able to connect this to the supernova community and their analysis. And to do that, let me step you backward in time. Early on in the explosion, supernova explosion, the opacities are very strong. You're only privy to a photosphere, a thin shell. But as the supernova expands and opacities go down, you begin to see emission from the interior. And that interior is closest to the heart of the explosion. That emission is powered by cobalt decay. And you see lines like these. It's often oxygen, calcium, and this was a hydrogen-rich event, so we see the hydrogen. Okay? And these are velocities of, 3,000-4,000 kilometers per second. It's years later, the timing dependent, of course, on the properties of the explosion and its environment. Years later, look what happened in this case. And this when I saw this data set, it blew my mind, and I asked Rabina Kotek so I can make this figure for the handbook, right? That's why that question mark is there. I have no idea when this chapter is going to be actually published because everybody seems to be taking their time. It may be years from then. Anyhow, if you look at it, this 400 days later, notice the velocity difference. Okay? So originally it was heated from the inside out. Okay? But now it's the reverse shock has begun to interact with the ejecta, and it's sampling much higher velocities. I think this is a reasonable definition of a supernova to supernova remnant transition. In this particular case, one can always come up with exceptions. Anyhow, this is the epoch that we're going to be under investigation right now. So about 10 years ago, a growing sample of these late-time observations were made. They're difficult because supernova fade relatively rapidly, and getting them a year after explosion is not trivial. But as the data quality improved, they began to resolve features. And if you have a spherical distribution of a transparent gas, the integrated profile is a parabola, essentially, so a pseudo-Gaussian, let's say. So deviations from this reflect asymmetry in the ejecta, and they saw a large asymmetry. Sometimes it would be single peak, sometimes it would be multi-peaked. In fact, they argued that they were seeing double peaks. And there's that plot that Laura showed earlier. And I have props. Okay. So if you have a jet, which I'm representing by the banana, okay, the jet will push out along the in these directions and form bow shocks from which a torus, represented by this bread bagel, I didn't have a donut, right, such like this. Okay? And this was related to a GRB event. So they came up with the model that if you're looking down the barrel of the gun, or the banana in this case, right, you're looking at the expansion of the torus face on, and that gives you a single-pointed distribution. However, if you look at it in this direction, okay, you don't see the jet, and you see the forward and back of the ring, and that gives you a double peak profile. Made for some exciting ideas, but I'll tell you, the punchline is that story didn't pan out. But that didn't stop people from getting really excited, and they started seeing double peaks everywhere. Okay? It was really exciting. You know, jets could be incorporated into more ordinary type 1 BCs. Now, I looked at this sample at some point, and came to a slightly different conclusion. Here on the right side, I've organized it by what I call asymmetric peaks. So there's some central distribution and then various degrees of something towards the blue. Always towards the blue, actually. So if you want to interpret this as a torus, okay, the central absorption point of the distribution represents the central velocity, right? So it should be, like in these cases, you see how they're straddling zero velocity, so that rests. But if this is a torus, like in this case, that means it's coming towards you 2,000 kilometers per second. Why are they always coming towards us? Right? This is where I get the flying donut idea. And then in the other case, in the symmetric peaks, if you look closely, the spacing seemed to be very close. Now, there's a lot of noise here, and the quality of the data not only would be very good, but in the case where it was resolved very well, I noticed that the separation was 64 angstroms. Okay? Now, this is in the auction 1 doublet, and I've done the math here for you. This is 6364 minus 6300, that's 64 angstroms. Okay? So my interpretation is that this isn't flying donuts, and Laura, are you ready for it? It's coming your way. Okay, there you go. It's not flying donuts, but it's actually various degrees of mixing. Nickel-rich plumes moving out to velocities of 5,000 kilometers as we see in Cassay. So we did the very simple experiment of looking, of using this as a template, where you have hot spots of cobalt heating in various directions, right? Heating this overall oxygen distribution. And if you look at it from various directions, could you represent the ejector profiles? And we've had fairly good success when you look at the fact that so the model is in blue, the actual data is in red. We only have oxygen. This is a supernova that has many emission lines, and so the wings may be filled in there, but we're able to get basic structures as a result. So I'm arguing this connection from the remnant stage to these intermediate stage and now to the actual early stages of the supernova itself. Oh, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to flash ahead here to some of the more, to leading to the future. And this is where I talk about progenitor structure. Stars are doing things slightly before they die. Here's a dramatic example of 2009 IP, which is a silly name because the actual explosion took place in 2012. Okay. But in 2009, there was an outburst that reached minus 15, not quite supernova luminosities, and we call this a supernova imposter. And as we followed the light curve with time, people were clever to do so, we saw these fluctuations, right? These were kind of consistent with what we see in the class of luminous blue variables, but that connection is not rock solid. But there is an analog object you can have in your mind. But then here in August 2012, there was a large peak and then a larger peak subsequently 40 days later. Okay? There's some debate about whether or not this was the actual terminal explosion of the supernova. But there's evidence that suggests that it is. I would say more so, but I have to give that caveat. But for sake of argument, let's say that this is a terminal explosion. The timing between the core collapse and this precursor activity is hard to ignore. This is months to years before the explosion. Right? And this is now remarking on an exciting time in the supernova field because we have the ability, if you change this around, you can predict a supernova explosion. You find a system that's undergoing this precursor activity. Perhaps if you watch it in the next months to years, it'll explode. In fact, that's already happened. In the case of a system NGC 2770, there is a supernova imposter-like outburst, followed it 9 months later, the explosion was observed. Okay, and this isn't limited to just hydrogen-rich explosions. There's a system, 2014C, that when I originally looked at it, it was a Type 1b. What does that mean? It means the star was largely stripped of its hydrogen at the time of explosion. Months later, I began to see the interaction effects with a hydrogen-rich envelope. Right. So the interpretation is that this system, this stripped star, had some kind of enhanced mass loss and/or violent ejection of its hydrogen-rich envelope in 100 to 1,000 years prior to explosion. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, this Conti scenario of a massive star going through an LBV phase for tens of thousands of years to the Wolf-Rayet phase lasting half a million years, it seems to not be the case, at least in some instances. And this may be related to binary interaction and/or common envelope ejection. So this idea that a lot of people have shown this plot, and I've used it myself too, this onion skin interior, you start to get this out of your brains, okay? At least in the stages approaching core collapse. Okay? Instead, you should have this kind of turbulent interior inside, in your mind. And try to think of an explosion making its way into such a perturbed interior. Okay? In fact, these simulations have shown that an explosion, otherwise broadly symmetric, exploding into this kind of perturbed interior allows the explosion to progress more easily and actually enhances the formation of the nickel bubbles that I was talking about earlier. Okay, I see that we're out of time, so I'm just going to give just a couple moments here. It's going to go into the questioning period, but I think this is important, especially for a lot of the people starting out in the community. How do we move forward? Okay, because we've made the question much more difficult for ourselves. Not only do we need to know the explosion mechanism, is it neutrino heating, is it jittering jets, is it magnetic fields, but now we need to worry about the type of star that it's moving into. And can we unravel asymmetries in the progenitor structure from asymmetries in the explosion? Okay. One way to do this is through LSST. And a lot of people are, you know, there's going to be found 100,000 supernovae per year. And I'm on one of the steering committees, and they're all excited about the highest cadence to find the earliest objects. That doesn't excite me. What excites me are the negative light curves that we're going to get. Currently, this is the only event by which we have a detailed light curve. That, you know, instead of going this way, we go backwards in time. LSST will have the depth and the cadence by which to do this for nearby systems. Okay. And now we are in the era of multi-messenger astronomy. Okay. There's a lot of hoopla about this, and I encourage everybody to take advantage of the gravitational wave hoopla. All right. So there's a lot of talk. Yes, it may be tomorrow, or it may be 20, 30 plus years from now when a galactic supernova goes off that we're able to detect with LIGO. But it will happen. And there's a lot of exciting science to be done in the gravitational waves and neutrinos. But any interpretation of those signals relies on simulations. And we don't want the simulations to go off in la-la land. They need to be rooted in firm observational constraints. And that's what this kind of work can help contribute to. Right? And so I'm saying it here first. We're going to lead the era of precision supernova tomography. I've started it with Cassiopeia, which seems to have disappeared, as well as EO-102. But there are a variety of other remnants for which other people have started the work, to which I hope to continue to build upon, by which we can, in a diverse family of environments, by which we can constrain the events. Now, with my time having run up, I'm just going to flash through these points here with the takeaway point that the progenitor systems are very important, not just the star itself, but the structure into which the explosion proceeds. I think that through detailed kinematic and chemical reconstructions, we can lend insight, unlike any other, about the explosion mechanisms and that progenitor system. And the future, as far as LSST and multi-messenger astronomy, is very exciting for the remnant community. Thank you very much.
Questions for Danny? Let's go to Steve.
Nice. Are we on here? Nice collection of motivating science. A particular question about the nickel bubble effect, whose author, by the way, is in the audience, and whose paper should have been cited, Lee McRae and Sunyaev, 1993. At any rate, for Cassiopeia...
It's cited in the paper, that's absolutely right. That the idea came from 87A, from which that work was started, exactly.
But we heard earlier in this meeting from Salvatore Orlando, there was an alternative description of a mechanism to make those structures, which was to have denser clumps going through and blasting rings out. Is there an obvious observational test that could discriminate between that and nickel bubbles?
Okay. I'll be honest, I'm not familiar with that idea. Can you repeat it? And or if it takes so much time, we can discuss it afterwards. But
well, perhaps I'm not correctly characterizing the talk a few days ago, but my impression was that this is a simulation involving denser than average clumps that that were less decelerated and resulted pistons. Yeah. Pistons.
Oh, this is Orlando's talk.
That's
you're
right.
Describing. Well, Orlando, you're maybe the one to discuss on, but that was just artificially put inside to drive the features in that direction, right? So I don't know if that's an accurate representation of the actual physical processes that's going on.
Yes, actually what we did was to prescribe some dense knots in the post-explosion evolution of the supernova. Of course, the physical origin of these knots can be, for example, that during the explosion you may develop some hydrodynamic instabilities. Maybe this can be seeded by neutrino-driven convection. And in this case, these instabilities may be very efficient to produce metal-rich knots at the terminal ends of the fingers of the hydrogen instabilities. So basically, we start with the idea that we have dense knots. But of course, we need to produce these knots. This may be produced during the supernova explosion, or maybe, as Dan is suggesting, this may be produced in the pre-explosion evolution of the progenitor star. And what we are saying is that if you have these dense knots produced in some way, these knots may reproduce the final morphology, the final distribution of eject observed in Cassay. Of course, what we are missing in our study is how to produce these knots. We are just saying these knots should have this energy and this mass. So what we need to do is to check if these energies predicted by our simulations, if these masses predicted are consistent with masses of knots produced in the post-explosion evolution of the supernova or during the phases before the explosion. And the way, I mean, just to answer your question, if there is any way to distinguish between different, well, I mean, I think that the only way is to check the different mechanisms, which one is able to produce knots with the characteristics we found. So I think this is the only possibility to distinguish among possibilities, different possibilities.
Related to things, and but first of all, thank you very much for your very impressive talk. And you kindly introduced our simulation about the ion velocity distribution together with the Max Planck team simulation. And our group, the simulation as well as Max Planck simulation showed low velocity ion velocity distribution. As you mentioned that our calculations are for type 2P supernova, which has a lot of hydrogen envelope, so that can decelerate the ion velocity. So we are very interested in doing a simulation for type 2B simulation for cancers, and I expect that the more high velocity ion component will be seen, as well as I wish a huge bubble, ion bubble, like you suggested for Cassie. So that might be seen in such a simulation, because progenitor dependence is quite huge, as Anup Wong Watanarat showed. Even for type 2p progenitor stars, the resulting ion velocity is very different. So if we do type 1 to B simulation, is resulting clump and velocity distribution should be very different. So I'm quite interested in doing such simulation. So thank you very much.
And thank you. I'm want to work with you as much as possible. You're emphasizing again that the progenitor structure can change the dynamics of the explosion, and so that places a lot of emphasis on getting that progenitor structure correct in order to follow the dynamics of how it evolves.
Okay, last question.
I just want to add to Nangataki-san there. We are already working on the type 2B model. And I can say that when you remove the hydrogen envelope, you retain more the asymmetry, the large scale asymmetry from the explosion, because you just don't have the strong reverse shock that forms at the helium and hydrogen interface and runs into the nickel. And also you will get a higher velocity, you can mix nickel to higher velocity. I can say that you can expect half of the nickel to go beyond 4,000 kilometers per second. That's easy to get. So there's not much of a problem in that direction from the modeling side for the high velocity nickel.
Right. Yeah. So again, an important constraint for you is to know what the actual nickel as traced by iron distribution is for Cas A or other remnants, right? So in the case, I made that contrast with EO-102. We don't have that nice shocked iron to give us a handle, right? So again, the morphology seems to be the same, but the explosion particulars are different.
Okay, let's thank Danny again.